Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Today, we have Richard Spencer with us, who's back on the show. He is, of course, behind the NPI events and also Radix Journal. Thank you so much for returning with us, Richard. Great to have you here again.
My pleasure, Henrik. Thank you.
Excellent. So we have a number of things, of course, we'd like to get into here today and talk a bit about it. I definitely want to get your take on the RNC event. I want to ask you a bit about some of the events with the Pope this past week here, too. But tell us a bit about Detroit first. You actually took a little visit and a trip there. Was this planned? What was the reason for this?
Oh, it very much was planned. We had an alt-right gathering, alt-right Detroit. Believe it or not, it's happening.
Are there any white people left?
There are, yes, and they have been red-pilled by life, as we say. But it's very interesting. I think everyone should go to Detroit at some point. And I think certainly every nationalist should go to Detroit, or every person who thinks that race is real and not just some figment of our imagination or a part of a system of economic oppression or something like that. Because I think you get to see the collapse firsthand. Actually, one of the places we visited on, we took a tour of Detroit, touring the ruins of Western civilization, circa 2016. We took a tour with about a dozen of us, and we went to places like the Packard plant, which is this huge manufacturing facility. And it was manufacturing luxury automobiles. And then during the Second World War, it was one of the big arsenals of democracy, as they said. And then it actually was collapsed and went out of business in the 1950s. I don't even know the full story of what happened. We've forgotten about the Packard automobiles. But it is it's truly spectacular to see this complex that has been abandoned and overtaken by nature. I think also the famous Michigan Central Station, which is in Detroit, it's an abandoned skyscraper. There's no other way to describe it. It's actually, if you saw the recent Batman v Superman film, that's where the big fight takes place, is in that building, which is pretty cool. They were looking for something gothic, so they went there. But I think it's a kind of 1-2 punch where you had a boom and bust of industry, and then you had this social phenomenon that we call the 1960s, where there was white flight. There was race riots. Eventually, there was just this dislocation, and it was a 1-2 punch that really destroyed the city. So you had these, population was doubling every 10 years. The first half of the 20th century, Detroit was known as the Paris of the West. It was
right.
Detroit. I guess. and then it became Detroit. Ever since I've been alive, whenever someone says the word Detroit, you kind of cringe or laugh or chuckle maybe or something like that. But it really is truly a disaster. You'll drive through neighborhoods and you'll see a family that's, say, packed with a bunch of people, a lot of obviously very black city, and then you'll see there it's right next door to a house that has literally collapsed in on itself. And then you drive a little bit further down the block and there's a house that caught flame and burned down and no one has bothered to clean it up. There was actually one burned down house that on the roof you could see this kind of, patriotic or liberal graffiti that says "the dream is now" on the roof of a house, and this house is burned down. It is truly spectacular. I mean, I guess we're indulging in Schadenfreude or something, but it's something that should not be missed. But the reason why I was there was not just a tour of Detroit. That was a something. It was a gift that came along with it. But we actually had an alt-right gathering, in a really beautiful place in Detroit that was a kind of ruin itself. It's being refurbished very slowly. I'm not sure I should give away all the info of where we were. We don't want to encourage drone strikes or anything like that. But we were at this beautiful place, and I was speaking. Sam Dixon was speaking. Kyle Bristow was there, among others, and it was really a wonderful conference. I mean, it was maybe not as big as a MPI event or AMREN or something, but it was a major event. And we really had a great turnout. I would say 60 people would be probably the low estimate. There was probably like 75. We, you know, got to meet one another. You know, it was Twitter, you know, in real life, where we're shaking hands, we're getting to know each other, we're talking about what we're doing, what we should be doing. So it was really a fantastic event, and I think we've crossed a Rubicon. I mean, we were talking about this afterward, and everyone agreed. I was actually talking with Reactionary Tree, who I think a lot of people probably know through Twitter, but yeah. We crossed the Rubicon. I mean, there was a time when you might even, you know, travel to another city and meet up with, say, six people and talk about what's going on and complain about the world. We're now hosting these regional private conferences that are like, you know, little mini MPI or AMREN events, and this is happening on a regular basis. I think we could probably, I think if we get together and start pooling resources, I think we could have one of these every month. It's really remarkable where we're going, and everyone there, I would say the average age is about 30.
Good.
Everyone's on the same page. Sometimes you'll experience this generation divide. Where you'll meet someone who just, you know, sometimes it's age, they don't really seem to be with you. They, you know, they're the kind of like, let's fight illegal immigration and vote Mitt Romney types or something. You know, you'll kind of meet someone who doesn't really seem to get it or like, oh, you can't say that, you know, oh, you know, we've got to be practical, which means, you know, accomplishing nothing. And, but I don't think I met one person like that. Everyone was on the same page. Everyone was alt-right. Everyone was very supportive of what everyone's doing. I think we've really crossed a Rubicon and we can't go back, where we can start to host major regional meetings on a regular basis. And I think the best way to do it as well is to pool resources. I think these would be best. These would be best if someone takes the bull by the horns, but that they have an organic quality, because a ton of these people have, you know, met each other via the right stuff or things like that. They've had some little small meetings together, and I think it's good to kind of keep these things organic. Don't centralize them too much. Just have one person in charge of his region. But yeah, I mean, we were already planning to do this again in Detroit. In a year, and I talked to another people like, let's do St. Louis, let's do Chicago, let's do Seattle, and I think we should. I think it's a good model as well, a kind of private model where you don't announce it. It's private, it's invitation only. You might release some video or audio, and we just start to kind of slowly vet people and get them in. We keep everything, you know, reasonable, pretty inexpensive, and we can have these meetings. I think there definitely is a time to have big meetings, but I think this is a really good supplement that goes along with it. And it's, you know, it's not as grand in many ways, but then it's, you know, kind of maybe a little bit better in some ways, and then it's more casual. So anyway, it was just a fantastic meeting. I'm very excited about what's happening.
Excellent. So, I mean, we've touched upon this a couple of times, but just let's reiterate these points. Why are so many coming in so fast? I mean, what, the last year, really? Year and a half? I mean, incredible numbers, right?
Yeah, this is a sociological question that I don't think there's one single answer to it. I remember at the MPI conference in 2015, I talked a little bit about this, that people are coming to us, that they're being red-pilled by life to a great degree. It's not just that they read something I wrote or listened to one of your podcasts. They really are being alienated from contemporary society. They want something different. They know that something is profoundly wrong with the world. But it's just happening. Obviously, the Trump campaign is a huge factor here. It's probably an indispensable factor. And again, that in itself is a bit miraculous. I almost wonder if the Trump campaign isn't kind of like we're a projection of us, where I don't think Trump decided to run for president in order to change the discourse and inspire the alt-right, But that's what he does. That's what he's done. And I think maybe a lot of it is our projection onto him, but that's okay. Trump has certainly done this. I think the refugee crisis was just such a stark expression of a race war. It's a war by other means. It's not like the one that you might have read about in books or imagined, but that's what it is. It is a grand clash of civilizations, a culture war. And we are experiencing that. I don't know if you can see these images and come to any other conclusion but ours. So I think all of this has happened. I think also there's just, you know, things, everything is born and everything dies. And this, a certain kind of Americana or, you know, a certain kind of conservatism that we're used to, we've been doing this for a while. It hasn't really accomplished anything. It's natural that something like that is going to die. And it is. And I think also this is also just, amplified by the internet and things like Twitter, the, you know, Chans, the forums, so on. We're all communicating with each other. It's not just a, you know, we have a little circle of friends in the city. It's that we're connected to people in Ohio, we're connected to people in Paris, France, we're connected to people in Scotland, we're connected to people in Texas. Something's happening that's bringing this movement together.
Did you get a chance to ask how some of the people that were at the Detroit event were introduced to any of this? I've been trying to figure out for a long time. What is it that attracts? Okay, that's good. Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Some said, "Oh, I listened to your podcast about a movie." And then I was like, "Whoa, where are these guys coming from?" And then I started. But I would say this. I think that people like you and I and other, you know, our Kevin McDonald, people who are creating content for the movement, I think, you know, it might be a difference between being a catalyst and being a cause, or you could say a necessary but insufficient cause for something. Think about this logically. I really do believe that these people are being red-pilled by life and that they recognize in their bones that something is wrong and that something radically different is needed. And I think it's really only a matter of time before they find us. And so I think that is what's fundamentally happening. But again, I think I might have told this anecdote on your podcast the last time I was on, but when I was at the NPI conference, I made a passing joke about paleo conservatives, and someone said, "Oh, what is a paleo conservative?" And you know, I guess I've just been doing this for so long that anyone who was in our movement would have caught that reference. You can Google it. Google paleo cons and Paul Gottfried and that kind of thing. You can read about paleo cons. Interesting movement, definitely dead. I made this, passing joke, and the guy said, "Oh, what is a paleocon?" And I was like, "Oh, wow." I was like, "How long have you been in this?" And he said, "Oh, I just started listening to your podcast 9 months ago." And so, you know, there are, and he's already attending a major event. So it's this new thing where more people are coming, and how do I put this? They're more recent as well. All of these things are amplifying. I did a poll not too long ago. Radix Twitter feed did a poll, totally unscientific, obviously, as a Twitter poll, but just how long have you been here? And again, you'll get like 20% of the people who identify with the alt-right and are, you know, creating content, interacting on Twitter, maybe attending conferences. They're under a year in terms of being red-pilled and being part of this. So what's happening is pretty amazing. And I think we should just keep doing what we're doing, because obviously what we're doing is working. I think the thing that really scares me is if a couple of scenarios, Trump doesn't win and we become demoralized and despondent. We think, oh, there's no hope. Well, no, this movement is not about Trump. You know, he is amazing. It's an amazing phenomenon. And he could be a great vehicle for a lot of ideas, or at least a kind of nationalism that approximates our ideas. But it's not about him. So that scares me. Maybe the other side of the coin scares me if he wins and then we become, you know, in a way equally demoralized because we think, oh, we won. We don't have to do anything
anymore.
He's
going to fix it, right? Yeah, we become complacent or something. I was thinking about that
exactly.
Too, but yeah.
So I think basically, you know, I've said this before. it's not so much about what happens, it's how you respond to what happens. And so I could think of a Trump loss being good. I could certainly think of a Trump victory being great for a movement. But the key thing is that in any of those things, that we just have to respond to it correctly. We have to keep going. We have to keep pushing. And we have to recognize that this not electing Trump really is not going to, it's not really about making America great again or something like that. We have a much bigger cause and a much bigger movement than that. And if this can get us closer, that's fantastic. But it's not, you know, on January 20th, 2017, if he's being inaugurated and he starts, you know, he's doing hilarious tweets and making fun of world leaders on his Twitter account. This will all be very amusing. but, you know, we have something bigger in store. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm thinking. But I don't think it's going to stop, because I think Trump has actually amplified racial division. I think he's amplified the fragmentation that's going on in the United States. I don't think he's put a damper on it. I don't think he's allowed people to avoid seeing it. I think a typical white Republican like Jeb, or even Marco Rubio, who's a, you know, effectively a white Republican, however he might want to describe himself, I think that kind of thing might lead to a certain, you know, a deluded state, or a certain blindness where white people in the United States think, oh, you know, we're in charge. You know, we've got old Jeb in office. It's going to be okay. Let's just talk about free markets and tax cuts and the Constitution. But that's not the case with Trump. Trump has really amplified consciousness, and he's amplified fragmentation. Whereas, where if you say that you like Trump, if you wear a Trump hat, in a lot of people's eyes, you are effectively saying that you're a kind of Nazi, or at the very least, you're a nationalist. Yep. Whether that's true or not is beside the point. That's how you're viewed by others. And so Trump has amplified this. And so I think that's a great thing. I think he's been a huge part of building this movement. He's probably been indispensable in where we are right now. But we've got to be bigger than Trump, and we've got to keep going. No matter what happens.
There obviously is a huge voter base that is attracted to Trump. There's millions of people in America, I'd say probably millions in Europe too, that are attracted to him for various reasons.
Yeah.
I was thinking about other ways to tap into that. I just wanted to pick your brain a bit on that issue of what you think might be the best way to reach those people, not just those who are being red-pilled by life, as you said before, but actually actively like reaching out to them instead of them coming to us. Have you thought about that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say this, that it's only a small percentage of a society that can really think for itself. And we often will go with something like an 80-20 rule of 80% of the people are going to be trapped in the prison of dominant ideology. and 20% are going to be able to at least think for themselves. It might be a 98-2 rule. That actually might be closer to reality. I think the best way to understand what we're doing is as a vanguard movement, that we're well out in front. We're out in front of Trump. I think Trump is the type of person that can reach these people, and that's been proven. It's not just that he's a rich guy. He is a reality star. He is a walking reality show. And it's also not just that he's an elite. It's that he's not an elite. He brings them real talk, and you can see this at his gatherings, where he's talking to them in a way that they understand, which is pretty miraculous. You could never imagine Steve Forbes, another multimillionaire, maybe billionaire, who ran for president. You can't even imagine him engaging in real talk with average folk. But Trump can do that. And so I think the way to reach that big 80%, or maybe it's 98%, is really through something like Trump. I think, you know, we haven't tapped, we're not tapped out on that 2% of people who can really think for themselves. And so I'm not sure I agree that it's really in the cards for us to be a populist movement. I'm not sure we can really achieve that, because we can't really offer your average person a lot. Becoming part of our movement means maybe being alienated from society, being ostracized, maybe being, you know, self-alienated and feeling, taking the black pill, as they say, feeling there's something profoundly wrong. I think most people don't want to think like that. So I think there's a power of being a vanguard and allowing other things to be a populist movement. I think what's interesting and what's dramatically changed is that the left has always had this dynamic where the left will have your Tim Kaine type politicians, really just boring, you know, not particularly intelligent. I don't care. He went to Harvard. I remember tweeting, I think I don't find McCain intelligent at all. They're like, oh, he went to Harvard. Yes, I went to a lot of these elite schools, plenty of smart people there, plenty of little test takers who are two-dimensional people who are meaningless. Tim Kaine is obviously one of those. Anyway, there's the Tim Kaine type person who is a, you know, he looks like an everyman, he's boring, he looks like your uncle or like the mayor of Missoula, Montana or something. And that's how you reach the broad swath of the left. But there's always this vanguard that's pushing the left further, that's coming up with notions like gay marriage or you know, white privilege or trans rights or all these kinds of things that the Tim Kaine types would never even imagine, or certainly the voters would never even imagine. The vanguard is always far to the left of its voters. When we shift over to the right, we have this opposite case where there's either no vanguard or the elite of the right is to the left of its voters.
Right.
So the GOP elite is, you know, they're wishy-washy, mealy-mouthed people who just, you know, want to make deals, only care about the party, aren't really thinkers at all. And there's been almost an absence of a real vanguard, of people out in front. You could maybe say that the William F. Buckley movement was a kind of vanguard for a little bit, and they obviously created a certain kind of terminology for conservatism. But I think we obviously need a new one, and the alt-right is becoming that. So this is the first time in my life where the alt-right is acting in a symbiotic and mutually beneficial relationship with a populist movement. I've always experienced hating Republicans, not wanting to be associated with them, thinking that everything they were doing was stupid. That was just, you know, maybe they were preventing the collapse by a few days, but that's nothing to be proud of. You know, just the Mitt Romney types, the John McCain types. John McCain might have been far worse than Barack Obama in terms of foreign policy and so on. I've been used to just hating Republicans, finding them utterly useless. Now we're in a new moment. We're in a moment where a vanguard has a mutually beneficial relationship with a populist movement. That is amazing. This is a new change. And I think this is also why so many people on the left are getting freaked out by Trump. You know, Trump's a moderate guy. You know, according to the little slide rule of the conservative movement, Trump's a perfectly moderate politician on many issues. But it's just that sense that he brings nationalism along with him, that he cares about us, and he has an understanding of them, and he knows who they are, and that he has this, you know, crazy alt-right group, you know, who they want to claim are, you know, people living in their mother's basement, though it's funny that they're always talking about us as a major threat to law and order, despite us being, in their minds, utter losers who are, you know, masturbating to anime.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, this is just a new place where we are. And it really has changed in the last year and a half. I mean, it makes me happy to be alive.
Well, indeed. And I think what you're talking about here is basically the conservatives, the so-called right, they have been in a position where they continuously compromise with the left, right? So what they become is not, it's not a conservative movement that actually conserves something. They just become kind of like, they're just like a brake pedal, right? I mean, if you compromise with the left, it becomes, okay, how quickly is our country is going to be completely replaced on a racial level, right? It doesn't become, should we have open borders? It becomes how much open borders should we have, right? I mean, that's the compromise level now.
At best, you can't win. That's what they are.
You can't win on that, right?
No, at best, that's what they are.
Right.
And sometimes they're actually worse.
Oh, in this case, of course.
Yeah. Republicans have promoted immigration far more than the Democrats have,
right,
historically speaking.
Yeah.
So, that's the situation where we were, and I think we're in a new world right now. Something has changed. I will be a little bit depressed, to be honest, if Trump, let's say, loses and you just have this reset where it's like, okay, let's go back. We did that was not good. We told you it wasn't going to work. Let's go back to conservatism. Let's hit the reset button. But, you know, as we know, you can't really ever hit the reset button. You know, something's changed you. You might, even if you think about your own personal life, you might go down the wrong path and I don't know, get into something that's bad, get into drugs or whatever, get into a terrible soul-sucking relationship or something like that. And you can say, all right, I've got to end this. I've got to get out, hit the reset button. Well, you're never really reset. You're always changed by the experience. And I think that's a lot like what I hope will happen to the right. That is my great fear, is that they hit the reset button and it actually works. But I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can unsay the things Trump has said. I don't think you can, unsay all these things that liberal journalists and so on have said about the alt-right movement as the great threat to law and order.
Yeah.
I think we just need to keep going. But we need to learn something from the left. We need to be a vanguard, and that means we're always pushing. And we're always pushing the boundary. We're pushing the politician somewhere.
Well, we have to, because we have to push back, right? I mean, as I said, the conservative and moderate movements have been compromising with the left, which means that the spectrum has continuously moved to the left, right? So we have to blaze a trail, and we have to a certain extent, be extreme in the consideration to the political spectrum where it stands today. Our position actually isn't that extreme, right? But it has become, because the spectrum has moved so much to the left. So we have to push back.
Yeah, and Sam Dixon said this at our little Detroit meeting, and I've heard him say this before, and it's very true, and that is that after you had this mid-century revolution in the United States with this 1-2 punch of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Immigration Act of 1965, which radically changed immigration from being actually very pro-white immigration and being white immigration every year to basically being anti-white immigration and to being greatly increased. And all the things that went along with it, the earlier desegregation of schools, the transformation of society that we call the 1960s, all of it. If we had not bothered with the conservative movement and just said, let's try a movement of repatriation of African Americans. Let's try to help them create an ethnostate of their own. Let's start talking about our own ethnostate, what we want. And everyone would have heard those notions and been like, that is utterly insane. Why would you even mention something like that? We're pragmatists here. We get things done. Well, the fact is, those pragmatists haven't gotten anything done. And we would have been further along. We would have been better off. We would have had more institutions. We would have been better funded. We would have had our ideas in the discourse more if we had actually gone radical after that point and not been conservatives and not listened to conservatives. And I would say, I mentioned this in my talk. I think you always need to we need to attack the right. The left is always going to be there. We can't really change the left. I'm sure we're going to bring along a number of former leftist converts. I think that's true, but that will take care of itself. We can't really change the left as a big phenomenon, but what we can change and what we can actually have an effect on is when we attack the right, when we attack the conservatives, when we work to replace them and not just think that, oh, these are some good guys in the Beltway. They're doing the best they can. We should all support, these types. No, we need to attack and replace all of those, so-called conservatives and rightists in the Beltway, in publications and so on. We need to be them. And I think that's happening. The conservative meme, that basically sums it up. The alt-right gets it on a really deep level, that we have to attack our left, but attack the so-called right the phony right, the cucks.
Yeah, as you said, I mean, things, they die, they're born, things are reformed, they're reshaped. I mean, there's certain things politically that has come and gone, and there's no sense of rights in the political world, right? Where, oh, a conservative, way of life is always going to be there, and somehow it's guaranteed by, authorities that it's going to exist. No, it's about who adapts to the circumstances of the times, who faces reality, and who attracts more people, right? I mean, and again, that's what Trump has managed to do. He's managed to tap into that sense of urgency, sense of need for security, addressing the real issues, and that's why people are attracted to it. The Republican Party might be forever reformed after this, if he wins. And where are those other people going to go? Well, they're going to probably start a third party or something, right?
They might go to the left. There seemed to be a certain kind of subliminal messaging going on in the Democratic convention, and a lot of these cucks picked up on it, like Rich Lowry and Ramesh Panuru and others, where they were talking about, oh, look, at the Democratic National Convention, they're talking about the American exceptionalism and, the Constitution and the founding fathers. Look, they're
military, praising the military, stuff like that, right? Pretty rare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And kind of doing it in their own way, like, praising a Muslim in the military, a great
course.
Hero.
Yeah.
Just real quick on a quick digression. I do find it amazing how Donald Trump, if Donald Trump had been president beginning in 2001, these Muslim family, the Khans or whatever, their son would be alive because Trump would not have engaged in the Iraq war.
That's right.
Yet apparently Trump is the bad guy. And we all need to support Hillary Clinton, who not only voted for the Iraq war, but backed it, supported it. Her ideology backs it, she's the one we should vote for. And Donald Trump is a terrible racist.
It's amazing.
I do find
it
kind of amazing. But anyway, I think there was, I think that the Democratic Party is a big, I've described conservatism like this. It's a jigsaw puzzle where the pieces don't fit. I think that probably that analogy holds for the Democratic Party as well. There was a lot of kind of mixed messages going on where they need to placate the Black Lives Matter folks. So, you have a lot of, you bring up all these mothers of dead Black people who have been brutalized by the cops and so on. But then you need to also try to win over those kind of normal middle class, maybe lower middle class white people who will vote Democratic and have historically. So you have this walking expression of ennui and called Tim Kaine, who just is going to put you to sleep the moment he opens his mouth.
Right.
So you need to be like, oh, look, we're not the real crazy radical party. Look, this old Tim Kaine here, he's a former union guy and blah. So I think they're trying to do all these different things. And one of them, I think, was making a little bit of a pitch to the cuckservatives of the Never Trump. Now, I would say that the Never Trump is a beltway phenomenon. I don't think that has much, I don't think that has roots outside of people who work for conservative magazines and think tanks and foundations and so on. But for them, it's real. I don't know if the Democrats thought that they could actually win over some former Republicans. Maybe they can win over a small amount. Whenever I listen to some of these radio shows, I've actually listened to the Eric Erickson show, and all of his callers who are these, you could call them redneck types, real salt of the earth type people. They're calling up and they're like, Eric Erickson, what are you thinking? What are you doing? You're going to elect Hillary by this nonsense. So I don't think Never Trump is a widespread phenomenon at all. But I think there was an appeal. And let's also remember, there's someone like Robert Kagan is a major neocon thinker. This is someone who was, glorifying the Bush administration and so on in the pages of the Washington Post during that era. He's deeply connected with neocon thought. His wife is actually a one Victoria Nuland.
That's was, right. Ukraine,
involved
right.
Is involved with the Obama administration, was deeply involved in creating the Ukraine disaster.
Yeah.
Truly horrible woman. This is his wife. And Robert Kagan is connected with the Hillary campaign. I wouldn't be surprised at all if the neoconservative movement, which has been lost a tremendous amount of legitimacy, certainly it has not lost its sinecures and think tanks and so on, has lost a tremendous amount of legitimacy. I wouldn't be surprised if they switch sides. In terms of a lot of the cuckservatives, the religious right, again, the religious right is a bit split on Trump. You have a lot of its leaders being anti-Trump. I would say most of its followers probably being willing to go along with Trump and maybe even liking Trump. But I don't see that working. It's hard to imagine the cuckservatives who are not neocons going over to the Democratic Party. I just can't see it. I think things like abortion will probably be a deal breaker. A lot of other things will be a deal breaker. So I don't think that's going to work. But I almost see that there's a little bit of subliminal messaging going on in the DNC where they're going to try to make that work. But again, I think the main thing that we need to do is build our foundations and replace the cucks. We need to be the right. We need to be the thought leaders of the right. We need to be a vanguard pushing conservatism, pushing populism in the right direction.
Of course. Yep, that's right. We have to be proactive. We have to get into politics. And there's many things we can discuss about this. It's a very interesting hearing. But I do want to spend some time before we run out of time here today about your banning in the UK. I mean, we have a potentiality now then of Hillary potentially being elected US president. You have Merkel in Germany, and then you have Theresa May that was assigned prime minister here recently. It's a kind of a trifecta of just a nightmare for the Western world. Tell us what happened with the letter that you received. Was it from the Queen or was it from Theresa May?
it was from Theresa May, although it had a lot of the pomp that one might associate with the Queen.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Just to go back real quick, yes, I remember learning in middle school that we just need more women in office. You know, things are going to be just so much nicer. These women are inherently tolerant and so on. Well, I'm not sure I like many of these women who are becoming heads of state, like Angela Merkel or Theresa May. Yeah, but just to go back to the story of my banning from the UK, I received a letter that said it was a FedEx letter or one of those services. And I opened it up, and it was this manila envelope, and it said, "On Her Britannic Majesty's Service." And I thought I'd been invited to tea with the Queen. It reminded me of, you know, something from James Bond, you know, "On Her Majesty's Secret Service." I was getting this letter. I was like, oh, at last, you know. You know, I'm being sent on a dangerous mission. I've been waiting for this since I was 12. But no, alas, it had nothing to do with that kind of stuff. I read the first paragraph and I pretty much knew what was going on. It said something, a language to the effect of, "From time to time, we ban extremists," and then it outlined a number of things. Interestingly, and keep this in mind, I am not a UK citizen. I am a foreigner, so I effectively have no rights in that country. But I'm not claiming that I have some right to be there or something, or, you know, my human rights are being violated. No, not in my worldview. That being said, it is very interesting that, you know, I have never been, I've never had any brush with the law outside of traffic tickets and parking tickets. And I don't know what the worst thing I've ever done before. I think I was caught underage drinking when I was 17. Sorry. You know.
It'll be used against you.
Right. Basically, I've done nothing that is illegal. I've certainly never called for violence or endorsed violence of any kind. I've been to Britain a number of times. I don't do anything there, but, you know, visit some friends, you know, do some tourist things, go to dinner with people. I mean, I'm the model tourist, but they are banning me for things that I think and say, and they made that clear in the letter. I am putting forth illiberal ideas, and they want to prevent me from entering the country. So it is a very sad state. I think the Brexit phenomenon was amazing. I think everyone would agree with that. And I think there was a lot of good in the Brexit phenomenon. A lot of people were voting because they want an identity, and they were voting on the basis of their identity. And you can see that with polls. It was about immigration. It was about national identity. It wasn't about, you know, free market capitalism or whatever the Brexiteers thought it was about. But let's just remember the politicians who benefited from this. The first was Boris Johnson, who benefited from it at the very beginning. This is a man who has openly advocated for Turkey to enter the European Union. And he is a man who has openly advocated not only for amnesty, but for increased immigration into Britain. I don't know what happened there. There seemed to be a kind of backroom intrigue. But the person who ultimately benefited from is this school marmish, Theresa May, very similar figure to Angela Merkel. This just radically frumpy, old, uncharismatic school marms. They remind you of your worst high school principal or, you know, some unmarried female who's never actually been made love to in her entire life and resents the world for it. that seems to probably an accurate description of some of these women. But anyway, Angela Merkel, of course, is married, but I wonder if she's ever been made love to. I seriously doubt. But anyway, I won't speculate any further on their personal activities, but they are truly frumpy, boring women, school marmish. But you can see how radically awful they can be. You know, Theresa May has actually been fairly good on immigration. I will hand it to her, a lot of her statements. But then she's also explicitly done things where she does not want our ideas to be allowed in her country. And that's it. That's inherently ridiculous, of course. People in Britain can download my podcast, read my writings, and read people like yourself and others who are saying a lot of the similar things. They can experience the alt-right all they want through the internet. So in a way, the banning is totally ridiculous. They're not accusing me of engaging in physical violence. They're trying to ban ideas.
Was there anything specific referenced here of why? Did you have a plan to go now coming up here or?
Very interesting. I had actually thought about returning to Britain.
So they read minds now, you know.
I don't think they're in there. I'm going to put a little bookmark on this conversation. I don't want to say more, but there's some suspicious things going on.
They're spying on us through your iPhone. You know what they have got going on there.
They obviously have the ability to do that. I don't think we should ever think they wouldn't do that. Or reading the emails of a British citizen whom I might have been in contact with.
Yeah.
I'll speak in vague terms here. I don't want to imply anything that is not true. But I was actually very seriously thinking about returning to England in this fall.
There you go.
So that might have instigated it. Interestingly, the documents, the evidence that they cited, they cited some of my speeches. I was thinking they might cite like an offhand tweet where I wrote something fairly offensive or stupid or something. But no, they cited some of my pompous speeches that I've given. And so, you know, it's all this stuff, you know, like in the ashes of the old world, we'll build the great, you know, the great Roman Empire of the future, all this kind of stuff. one of the speeches they quote, I actually said that I admired Theodor Herzl, one of the founding fathers of Zionism, in his ability to dream and change the world, to think, to imagine something that didn't exist and to make it so. So that was rather amusing. That they cited that
really interesting.
So it pretty wild stuff. But I would say this: look, I am not a British citizen. My last name is Spencer. My name is Richard Spencer. So I obviously have English heritage, and so that does make it. I think that made it a little bit sad for me. This notion that they're preventing someone named Richard Spencer from entering the country. You might remember Spencer is Spencer is a family connected to Winston Churchill and Lady Diana too.
Right, the Spencers weren't they the other half of the Darwin? Right, they were kind of.
We're everywhere.
But meanwhile, I mean, Richard, we have to address this issue. I mean, the glaring contradiction here of like the fact that the UK has number of ISIS terrorists that are actually being allowed back into Britain. I mean, even the fact that ISIS fighters must be allowed to be returned back to the UK. You know, headlines like this, that is just like, Well, we have extraordinary terrorist attacks on European soil, and they're worrying about you.
I know. It's amazing.
It is amazing.
Or Rotherham. They were afraid to even talk about the notion that there was this horrible culture of abusing young girls in ways that humiliating them in ways that I don't even want to describe or even think about. They were afraid to talk about this for a decade, and yet they're worrying about banning, you know, some writer from the United States. You know, I mean, yeah. It truly is amazing. Other thing, I don't want to give anyone a black pill, but look, I am not a UK citizen, so I don't have any rights in that country. I get that. But let's just remember, this is the way that they think. And, you know, this is a slippery slope argument, but sometimes the slippery slope is real. And there are people in the United Kingdom who are citizens. I won't name their names. They've been on your show. They've been on my podcast. Who think in the way that I think and you think. And I think those people should think of themselves as somewhat vulnerable. This wouldn't be something new. There are people in prison at this moment, put there by a government run by Angela Merkel for having, you know, unorthodox ideas about the Second World War or having unorthodox philosophical ideas. These are just ideas.
That's right.
But, you know, I would admit that I think maybe let's flip this around. Maybe they should ban me because ideas do matter and our ideas are dangerous for them. So, I mean, you know, on one hand, we might think of it as ridiculous, but maybe they actually are responding to something that we aren't just offering some new little policy tweak or something like this, you know, oh, right. We should just pull this lever, or turn this knob, you know, two ticks to the left. That's what we should do with this government. No, we really are offering a fundamentally different vision. We are offering a vision of a new order. And so I don't know if you're not getting banned from these countries, you're not being radical enough.
Let's just listen to her a little bit, though. I wanted to get your take on this. It's a longer clip, but we can listen a little bit to it. It's an interesting discussion that Theresa May has before she became prime minister.
First of all, I mean, the reason for doing this, John, I mean, you talk about tolerance and intolerance. I mean, there are people out there, sadly, who are seeking to divide us. We are a government of one nation. We want to bring people together to ensure we are living together as one society. But there are those who are trying to promote hatred and intolerance, seeking to divide us into a them and us and undermine our British values. And what we are proposing is a bill which will have certain measures within it, measures such as introducing banning orders for groups and disruption orders for individuals, for those who are out there actively trying to promote this hatred and intolerance, which can lead to division in our society and undermines our British values. But it will be part of a bigger picture, a strategy which will also have as a key part of it actually promoting our British values, our values of democracy, rule of law, tolerance and understanding, you know, acceptance of different faiths.
And freedom of speech, an essential prerequisite of a tolerant and decent society. And if you ban groups of people from getting together and talking about the things that worry them about the way our society is heading, don't you become a part of it?
No, well, first of all, I would say that your description of what we're proposing to do is not right.
Well, you're talking about banning groups of certain groups of people getting together.
We're not talking about banning groups of people getting together who are simply talking about problems in society or what they perceive as issues that need to be addressed.
So when do they step over the edge?
We are talking about the extremism of all sorts, Islamist extremism, but also other forms of extremism like neo-Nazism, that is seeking to promote hatred, that is seeking to divide our society, that is seeking to undermine the very values that make us a great country to live in, that make us this great pluralistic society.
And how do you divide a society then? Let's assume, for instance, that a group of people put together a meeting at which they expressed views about homosexuality that you or I might perhaps find repugnant. Would they be dividing society?
What we're talking about here is an extremism that is that has an impact, that is divisive, that is trying to undermine our values.
Well, that would be divisive, wouldn't
but
it?
That is trying to undermine our values. But the reason that we're doing this is, first of all, because we do need, I think, to ensure that we are together as one society. We are one nation. We are working
speaking
to ensure
with one
that
voice?
We, well, there will be different views within that nation. Of course there will be different views.
Indeed.
And nobody is suggesting that different views cannot be expressed. But one of the reasons for looking at this issue of extremism is the path down which it can lead people. And
all right,
what we
you know, she goes on there. But I mean, it's one of the things I think we should dig out from that is basically that she says, you know, but what we're talking about is the key values that underline our society and are being undermined by the extremists. Values like democracy, a belief in the rule of law, a belief in tolerance for other people. Equality and acceptance for other people's faiths and religions. One of the great things about living in the United Kingdom is that we have all a right to live our lives as we choose to live our lives. But no, these are the issues that she's actually going after. She's disallowing people from actually living their lives the way they want. They don't understand. It's so glaring, right? But
it is. It's a deep contradiction within liberalism, but it's also a deep contradiction within conservatism, you could say. And I'm glad you showed this clip to me because I'd never heard it before, but it's very interesting. Carl Schmitt talked about this contradiction of liberalism, and if I were to sum it up, it would be, you know, can a liberal society tolerate illiberal ideas?
Right.
Or can a parliamentary democracy allow within the parliamentary democracy forces like, say, the Communist Party or even the National Socialist Party that are there precisely in order to overturn Parliament. Carl Schmitt came to the conclusion that no, you can't, that you effectively have to break the rules of liberalism in order to maintain liberalism. So
that's right.
He would have no problem with expelling the communists because they weren't kind of part of it. They were outside the system of liberalism as opposed to being within it. So there is a glaring contradiction within liberalism, where you can talk about free speech, but then there becomes this pressing need for more speech control. And obviously, with mass immigration, there becomes a greater and greater pressing need for speech control, as you have radically different people entering the society. I think there's also a kind of glaring contradiction with conservatism because, you know, conservatism, you want to face the future backwards. You know, you want to be looking at your people and looking at the past and learning from it. You want to try to find a long unity. Conservatives think that they always distrust revolutions. You're trying to restart the world every few years and base something on pure rationality. No, it's much sounder to base something on the past, on history, and what works. The fact that we still have these institutions, whether it be the monarchy or the family or so on, that in itself indicates that they work, that there's something good about them, that we might have stumbled into these institutions, but we should learn from them. So I think that is one of the admirable aspects of conservatism. Well, the fact is, conservatives now are in a world that is dividing on its own. I mean, Richard Spencer is not dividing the United Kingdom. I wish I had such powers. I don't. The United Kingdom is being divided because you're bringing in radically different races, people with radically different religions that are in conflict, or a religion that's in conflict with people who have no religion at all, like Islam. That this is why the United Kingdom is breaking down. And a conservative like Theresa May, you could even say a conservative like Angela Merkel. Let's not forget, Angela Merkel is on the right in Germany. Her career began as a post-communist, kind of more free market-oriented person from the former East Germany. But you have Theresa May. She's this conservative. She wants to bring this oneness, a certain sense of nationhood to the United Kingdom. Well, that's not going to work. You can't have both. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have both. You can't have radically different people entering a society and then maintaining this sense of order and national community.
No.
So I think vis-a-vis people like Theresa May, even though you one could say that Richard Spencer or others were the extreme conservatives, well, okay, there's something to that. I certainly do look to the past for models. There are many institutions like the family and other things that I not only respect, but I want to revive and and expand. That being said, vis-a-vis people like Theresa May, vis-a-vis people like Angela Merkel, we are revolutionary radicals. You know, I in a way understand the fact that they don't want to tolerate us, because we are outside their system. We're bringing in something radically different. We're bringing in a new order. And I think we should recognize that, and, you know, it doesn't even matter if that's what, if that's how we see ourselves. You know, a lot of people in our movement probably don't want to think of themselves as a revolutionary. You know, those are the people we want to, you know, stamp out. And they want to think of themselves as being a true to tradition and so on. But this is how our enemies view us. And I think our enemies are right on this. We are offering an anti-system view. We are offering a different vision for society. And so it is natural that they view us as such.
So they will become conservative in their liberal values now then, right?
Right. They're conservatives protecting liberal values. I mean, that's, you know, another kind of irony of conservatism itself is that it is it's a relativistic doctrine. There were conservatives in the Soviet Union. You know, Brezhnev, you could say, was a conservative of the Soviet Union. He wanted to maintain the institutions. He wanted to maintain a sense of order. He wanted to have just enough, say, Russian nationalism, but not too much, just enough Marxism, but not too much. He is a conservative. So what we have now is this contradiction of conservatives, where they are attempting to maintain a oneness of these societies that are cracking up.
That's right.
And again, I don't think we should support them. I think that's what Mitt Romney wants to do, or Marco Rubio, or Jeb Bush, you know. Let's get everyone, we're going to hold this thing together because we're all going to be kind of rich, or we'll all believe in the Constitution or equality, or we'll all vote every 2 years or whatever. They're trying to hold this thing together through this kind of civic nationalism. Even Donald Trump is, too. Donald Trump is part of that civic national, trying to keep this all together. Let's make this great. Let's make this thing great again. The fact is, this thing is breaking apart. It's fragmenting, whether these people like it or not.
They've done it to themselves. They are the ones who have done this. That's what's so remarkable, right? I mean,
that's how every regime cracks up.
That's true.
I mean, look, Europe destroyed itself. Not really in the Second World War. Europe destroyed itself in 1914, and you know. You could blame it on the Jews or whatever, but the fact is, the people in charge were aristocratic Gentiles who did this to themselves. This is how the world changes. I think the world probably changes more by suicide than it does by revolution or murder.
I think they allow themselves to be manipulated to a certain extent as well. They allow themselves to be dragged into it. They allow themselves to be hushed along in some new crazy ideas because they're not in touch enough with what really matters and reality and nature, right?
Right. You can look at this also in disruption in the business world. It's actually those corporations that are at the height of their profits when everything seems to be going just great, when they actually get disrupted by something from maybe from the low end or something coming out of left field. I think it's similar to that with politics. I think we're in a different situation now because, in a way, what Theresa May is saying in that clip that you played, she's admitting to the fact that the elites within this regime, maybe she's not the upper echelon of the elite. She's some kind of elite. She's the prime minister after all. But the people in this elite recognize what's happening. They recognize that they're in danger of losing their power. They recognize that they're playing with fire. They recognize these fault lines which are coming up based on religion and race, really based on Islam and race, I would say, to be more accurately. I think this is sometimes it's actually you can learn a lot by listening to the most mainstream of people and how they think. Sometimes they'll actually give you an accurate portrait. People like Theresa May, people like Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel was saying truly outlandishly ridiculous things in her press conference just the other day. She said, you know, if we don't allow in more refugees, the terrorists will have won.
This is what they believe,
quote.
Right? Yeah.
Well, not an exact quote, but that's literally what she was logically saying.
The U.S. Remember, if Obama said if we close the borders to the Islamists, then they win, right? If we fight them, they win. If we kill them, they win.
Right. I think actually, if you fight and kill them, you've won.
You win, right?
I don't. Yeah. Maybe that's. I'm just. You know, I'm really a basic.
You're too traditional on those ends. You know, you're too backwards, too old fashioned. You know, it's a new world. Yeah.
Right.
Well, but. But obviously, I mean, there's two things here. One, obviously, you're being banned, not because they think you're a kook and because they just don't have anything better to do. They see you as a real threat. Otherwise, they wouldn't ban you, right?
But they're also not banning the Flat Earth Society.
No, of course.
They're banning me.
Yeah. So the rot, it takes a long time for rot to set in, you know, to a house, to make an analogy or whatever. But once that has occurred, it goes very quick for the collapse to occur, right? And I think we're seeing that now. And when bringing in third world people, you know, the Middle East and North Africa and these countries now into Europe, it's just a matter of time before this true collapse is visually. I mean, I would argue that it's almost here with terrorist actions every other day now, so quickly that we can't even cover them, you know, in time before another one occurs. That's evidence of a failing civilization, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I think we've already failed. I mean, and I think the collapse is in a way already taken place. I think sometimes people like Piero San Giorgio, whose book we published, or Gerald Celente, others, I certainly like and respect those folks, but I think they might be off in the sense that they think that this is all going to happen in one big day. We're going to wake up and then the morning news is going to say hyperinflation's here. It's all over. You know, go stock up on guns and canned food. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen. I think we might have a collapse that's similar to Detroit. The fact is, when you were in Detroit, you can witness the ultimate collapse scenario. You know, homeless people addicted to crack and so on, living in an abandoned skyscraper. I mean, houses literally collapsed in on themselves. You can also drive 2 miles and visit a Starbucks or have a nice meal at some hipster bistro, as we all did together on Sunday morning. So I think what's most likely going to happen is that this collapse is going to all happen. It's going to happen for over a long period of time, and I think it's already begun. And that it's going to be a Detroit-like collapse where it's you have great prosperity and utter destruction all occurring within the same city. And I think it's already happened. I think the amount of legitimacy that the system has lost is also something that we shouldn't overlook. And you can see that through the Trump campaign or the Bernie campaign. But you can just see that in just people's general outlook. You know, 70% of Americans think we're headed on the wrong track. You can look at the liberals now resorting to speech codes, outright speech codes, arresting people, banning them from countries. We're there. This might take a long time. We might not wake up one morning and there's hyperinflation. But I think we're going to be in a new normal where the kind of attacks like we saw in Nice, the kind of attacks seem to be happening every week. These terrifying things of women being macheted and train cars in Germany, this kind of thing. We're there. I mean, we are there. The collapse is occurring right now. It's not a matter of when. It's a matter of how this is going to occur and how long this is going to occur before a new system comes into place. And we need to be working desperately to making sure that that system is ours and not someone else's.
Yeah, indeed. I guess we're coming up to our end of our time here for this time, Richard. Just flying by the time here. We could go on for another segment probably, but I know you're busy and have to go soon. But what else would you like to finish on here before we wrap up? I mean, we didn't really get a chance to talk about the RNC. You had a good, campaign, whatever, going there. You were standing with a sign saying, speak to a, quote, racist, right? Tell us just a little bit of how that actually went.
It was a lot of fun. I did a little bit of that on Periscope, and I actually was there for a couple hours on, I think it was Tuesday, just in the center, this thing called Public Square. And I actually, we filmed an hour-long conversation between me and Jorge Ramos, the great Jorge Ramos broadcaster. It was a very good conversation. I actually did that for HBO. Yes, they could always edit this in some way that makes me look ridiculous. I don't think they're going to. I think we're a little bit over that. But Jorge Ramos was a very nice man, actually, and I tried to reach common ground with him. by talking about identity and how he cares about identity. And I think I did, actually. He said that he respected my courage at the end of the conversation. So it was a very, very interesting. Yeah, I did go out to the square and said, do you want to talk to a racist? I talked to a lot of quote racists. I obviously don't identify with that term, but sometimes you have to use the common parlance in order to reach people who have not taken any bite out of the red pill. Had some very interesting conversations, talked to some journalists with this kind of stuff. I just met a ton of people at the event. It was really a great for networking and meeting new folks. The alt-right had a presence at the RNC. I don't think we had any presence. I mean, people weren't really using the term alt-right as nearly as much as they are now, but I don't think we really had any presence at the 2012 convention. Now, these events like this are places where we're gathering and we're meeting each other and talking to each other. We're attending the parties. We're the ones that are making headlines.
The media writes about how the alt-right has infiltrated the RNC, right? They're on the inside right now. You know, it's funny.
Well, you know, it's kind of, I've joked about this. I actually told Rosie Gray, I said, you know, we're taking over the right. And I admit that that is a bit of truthful hyperbole. I mean, I am not going to be the president of the Heritage Foundation tomorrow morning, alas. But, you know, sometimes you have to you have to make something a self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes you have to be a bit hyperbolic in order to make sure that it happens.
You have to speak your vision into reality. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. You have to dream it before you can do it.
Yeah.
And that's how I thought. So I think sometimes it pays to be a bit outlandish.
Of course. Yeah.
And the fact is, we are, in a way, in the sense that we have a 1% of the funding, or less than that, perhaps, of the conservative movement. Yet we're the ones they talk about. We're the ones that haunt them in their nightmares. We're the boogeyman in their closet, of these conservatives. We're the monster under their bed. We're haunting them. And the fact that we're doing that because our ideas are powerful and our ideas are real, and I think they recognize that we are better than them. We are superior to them, and we deserve to be the vanguard of the right, and they don't. And so I think what's happening is really interesting. I don't want to seem like a pessimist, but the key really is to keep this up. We need to keep pushing. We might be getting less press interest after the election. Maybe Trump loses. We might hit some bumps along the road. But we've got to capitalize on all these things that we've done and all these new friendships that we've made and all these new comrades that we've brought on board.
So the next MPI event is after the election. So that's going to be very interesting. That's a delicate time in many regards. So npievents.com is always where people can pick up tickets. It's in November. Tell us a bit about that and what some of the things you have planned for this time, Richard.
Well, it's going to be an amazing event. As you said, it's going to be in Washington, D.C. It's going to be on November 19th. So that's roughly 10 days after the election. So we are going to be in a new world at that point because, you know, you never know really what's going on until you get there. And so I'm going to be there. Peter Brimelow is going to be there. Kevin McDonald's going to be there. Matthew Tate, you guys are going to be there. We've talked about a lot of crazy ideas in terms of making it an interactive event, making it a live, online live event, and not just an in-person event. F. Roger Devlin, a great thinker, is going to be there. Millennial Woes, who we've all, you know, come to know and love, is going to be there. There will actually be some other surprises. Tila Tequila, believe it or not, is going to... join us on Friday. She, you know, I would mention a couple things about Tila. First off, I talked with Tila over the phone, and I really respect her. She's a very good person, and she has very good motives, and I respect her intelligence. I think it's also good that we start developing some allies of color, that is, people who aren't necessarily on board with us completely, but who actually respect what we're doing and understand what we're doing. And I think we should have some real genuine outreach to people like that. And secondly, it's going to be crazy and a blast. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. Exurious is going to actually be doing some new music. We're going to actually have another small band of some alt-right people that they're called Upwards Path. So we're going to have some kind of folk music there as well. So it's going to be a full day event on Saturday, and we're going to have related events on Sunday and Friday. So it's just going to be fun. It's not going to be a boring academic conference. It's more about, you know, there will be that element. There'll be some speeches, but there are going to be a ton of panels. And it's really more about meeting people and having fun and having good food. It really is great food at the Ronald Reagan Building. Good drink, just being at a spectacular place and being in D.C. So it really is going to be a great event. And I think it's all the more special because it happens afterward. It might have been interesting to do it right before, because that would have been like a snapshot in time of our, you know, excitement and anxieties about Trump's election. But I think it might be better to do it right after, because we're going to be in a new state, and probably a new state of mind once we know what's happened. So I think it's going to be a very important event, mpievents.com, and just go there. You can, you know, look into it. You know, you're going to be able to meet, I would say, at the very least 200, maybe even 250 or so alt-rightists in one room, and, you know, eat dinner with them and you know, get to know them, talk about projects, all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a wild time, and I don't think anyone should miss it if you really care about this movement.
That was a lot of fun. Also, of course, radixjournal.com. Any other websites we should give out, Richard?
That's probably the best. Radix Journal is the best place to start. And there's mpiamerica.org, but less content there. It's mostly at Radix. I would also say we have a new section of Radix called The Red Pill, and this is actually going to be a book, and it's going to be an ongoing series. And it's really my way of addressing this issue of these new people. And I often will get questions like, what book do I read first? What articles do I read first? I'm not sure I have a great answer for that yet. So I'm trying to create that answer. So we actually have a couple of articles up there right now. One of them is a classic article from 2009 that talks about the alt-right and where we were then. We have an article on race by Roger Devlin and me. There's a classic article from Jared Taylor on what the founders really thought about race. We actually have a number of them in the can. They're going to be going up, like A Letter to a Young White Man, and so on. So I am addressing that question of how do we reach people? What do we do? And so this, The Red Pill, is going to be a new section of Radix that I think you're, maybe your listeners are already fully red pill. That's probably true. This is the thing you might want to send to your friend or send to your, you know, your mom, maybe.
We always get newcomers, and we should keep them in mind. We should not just preach to the choir and try to bring, you know, new exciting things to everyone who's already familiar with everything. So it's a good idea. Definitely think about the newcomer. Well, thanks, Richard. It was a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us today.
Pleasure is mine.
You're a fighter. You're a lover. You're strong and you recover from whatever gets you down. And there's so many, many reasons, any time, any season is the right time to be with you. Hello, Detroit, you've won my heart. Your Renaissance and waterfronts give you a flair of your own. Irresistible you, hug and kissable you, you're a
hello, Detroit. You